Welcome back to the Curtis Research Audio Archive.
Great to be here.
Today we're taking a look at Sufism. You might also know it as Tasawwuf in Arabic.
That's right, Tasawwuf.
We'll be exploring, you know, what it is, its history, core ideas, and the practices involved in this, well, this mystical dimension of Islam.
Exactly. The goal is really to get a clearer picture, drawing on the scholarly work and expert reports available.
So where should we start? Maybe with the basic terms.
Good idea. Tasawwuf itself, it literally means something like being or becoming a Sufi.
And the person following this path is a Yufi.
Precisely. Asfi. You also sometimes hear the Persian term, Irfan.
Irfan. What does that emphasize?
It really highlights the aspect of inner knowledge or gnosis, which is just so central to the whole thing.
Okay. Now, the word Sufi itself, its origin seems a bit debated, doesn't it? I saw a few possibilities.
Oh, yeah. Definitely debated. The most common theory, the one you hear most often, links it to uff.
Uff, meaning wool.
Exactly. Wool. The idea is that early ascetics, these pious figures, often wore simple woolen garments. It was a symbol.
A symbol of what? Detachment?
Yeah, detachment from worldly stuff, from luxury. It wasn't unique to Islam, actually, this idea of wool symbolizing piety.
Oh,
Abu Nasr al-Sarraj, an important early writer, pointed out that wool was seen as the clothing of prophets and saints.
So it had this established association.
Right. And another figure, al-Rudabari, added a nice layer. He said, well, a true Sufi wears wool outwardly, but only if it reflects an inner purity.
So the outer reflects the inner. Makes sense. But wool isn't the only idea floating around, is it?
Nope. There's also ivafa.
Ivafa, purity.
Yes, purity. And given that Sufism is so focused on purifying the heart, that connection seems pretty logical, too.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's al-Alufa, the people of the bench, or people of the porch.
Who were they, exactly?
A group of the Prophet Muhammad's companions, very poor but incredibly devout. They used to gather on a covered bench at his mosque in Medina, just dedicated to worship.
That's a powerful image, sort of early dedicated community.
It is. Then you have Uff.
Which means?
Rank or row. Maybe referring to those who were so eager for prayer, they were always in the first row.
Always at the front. Okay.
And finally, there's a connection. Some early scholars, like al-Biruni, considered the Greek word sophia.
Meaning wisdom.
Right. But modern scholars mostly think that link is pretty unlikely. Not much solid evidence for it.
So the wool theory, uff, seems to be the front runner. Symbolizing that ascetic lifestyle.
It seems to be the most widely accepted, yeah.
What's interesting, though, is that even if these practices were happening early on, the actual term tasawwuf,
yeah,
it didn't really catch on until later, like the 9th century.
That's a really crucial point. In the earlier centuries, people doing these kinds of things, they probably wouldn't have called themselves Sufis.
What would they have said?
They might have identified more with terms like Zuhd asceticism or far, which means spiritual poverty.
Okay, so the label came later.
Right. It wasn't really until the 10th century and then onwards that you start seeing these specific Sufi manuals appear.
And what was the purpose of these manuals?
They were super important. They defined the principles, laid out the practices, the ethical goals. Basically, they provided a framework for Tasawwuf. It was also partly about explaining its place within the wider Islamic world, maybe defending it a bit.
Defending it from who?
Well, sometimes from more legalistic scholars who might have viewed some practices with suspicion.
I see. And then much, much later, we get the English word Sufism, coined by Western scholars.
Yes. 18th, 19th centuries, Orientalist scholars. And their initial take, well, sometimes they presented it as almost separate from mainstream Islam.
Really? As something external?
Sometimes, yeah. Or maybe in tension with it. But that contrasts quite a bit with how many Sufis themselves saw it and how scholars like Niall Green argue it was viewed historically.
Which was?
That in pre-modern times, Sufism wasn't separate at all. It was deeply woven into the fabric of everyday Islamic life and thought. It's important to see both perspectives.
Okay, so pulling it together. If we had to define Sufism concisely, what's the core idea?
At its heart, it's the inner, the esoteric dimension of Islam. Think of it as a spiritual journey towards God.
A journey with a specific goal.
Definitely. The primary aim is to achieve direct, personal, experiential knowledge of God. Right here, in this life.
Experiential knowledge, like ma'rifa.
Exactly. Ma'rifa gnosis, intuitive understanding, or sometimes dhok, which literally means taste, a direct taste of the divine reality.
That focus on this life experience seems key, maybe different from a purely afterlife-focused approach.
It is a key distinction, yes.
And how do Sufis pursue this? What are the methods?
It revolves around spiritual purification, tazkiyah, cleansing the heart and the self, the nafs of negative traits.
And replacing them with?
With virtues. And alongside that, crucially, cultivating divine love. That's mahabba, or sometimes the more intense ish.
Love for God.
An intense, passionate love. The ultimate aim is to return to our primordial pure state, the fitra, where love for God is the main motivator.
And just to reiterate, this isn't a separate sect, right? It's found within both Sunni and Shia Islam.
Absolutely. Sufis see themselves as firmly rooted in the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet's way. It's often understood as the practical path to achieving Ihsan.
Ihsan. That's spiritual excellence.
Right. From that famous hadith of Gabriel, worshiping God as if you see him. Sufism is seen as the way to actually live that Ihsan.
Okay, that provides a really solid grounding. Now let's dig into the origins and how this tradition developed over the centuries. Sufis themselves seem pretty clear on where it comes from.
They are. They consistently trace their spiritual lineage back to the core sources, the Quran and the Prophet.
What, in the Quran specifically?
Numerous verses. Verses about God's nearness, you know, closer than your neck vein, or whithersoever you turn, there is the face of God. Those are often quoted.
Immanence them.
Yes. But also verses about the love between God and believers, the importance of remembering Baid constantly, dicker, inner purification, the day of judgment, the primordial covenant.
The covenant before creation.
Exactly. Sufis often use esoteric interpretation, talawil, to unlock what they see as the deeper mystical meanings in the text.
And beyond the text, the Prophet Muhammad's life itself is the model.
Absolutely. His simple life, his intense devotion, his night prayers, his retreats for meditation, even before the revelations began, like in the cave of Hira, all that is foundational.
The ultimate example.
The ultimate example. And as we said, that hadith of Gabriel is central. Sufism is the practice of Ihsan.
So starting from those roots, what's the first sort of tangible form we see historically? Was it the asceticism, the Zuhd?
Yes, that seems to be the earliest clear manifestation. It emerged quite early, partly as a reaction, actually.
A reaction to what?
To perceived worldliness. As the Islamic empire expanded rapidly under the Umayyads, there was a lot of wealth, maybe some luxury, and these early ascetics reacted against that.
Figures like Hasan al-Basri.
He's a key figure, yes.
Yeah.
Based in Basra, these Zuhad, these ascetics, focused on intense piety, detachment from material things, meditating deeply on the Quran, and just rigorous religious observance.
It's almost like a corrective impulse, isn't it? When the outer forms become very dominant, the inner path gets emphasized.
That's a really insightful way to put it. Yes, a kind of internal rebalancing.
So, from this general asceticism, how did it evolve into more specific mystical ideas and practices?
That shift becomes more noticeable, say, between the 8th and 10th centuries. The actual term Sufi probably starts getting used around the 9th century. Kufa, in Iraq, was an early center.
And key concepts started getting fleshed out.
Exactly. Things like tawakkul, absolute trust in God. And marifa, that inner intuitive knowledge, dhulnun al-misri, in Egypt, is strongly associated with developing that idea.
And divine love.
Yes, mahabba, championed so powerfully by Rabia al-Adawiyya, the early woman mystic. Her focus on selfless love for God was revolutionary.
She's such an important figure. And then you had others in Iraq, like al-Muhasibi and Junaid.
Right. Al-Muhasibi really focused on the inner life, self-examination, the psychology of the soul. Junaid of Baghdad was hugely influential in systematizing Sufi thought, emphasizing what's called the path of sobriety, a balanced approach to mystical experience.
Balanced as opposed to?
Well, as opposed to perhaps the more ecstatic expressions. Think of Bayezid Bastami.
His ecstatic sayings, right?
Yes. Utterances expressing overwhelming divine intimacy. And then, of course, Mansur al-Halaj.
Anahak, I am the truth.
Which ultimately led to his execution. Both were incredibly significant, expressing intense mystical states, but also generated controversy.
This period of development brings up the question of outside influences. Was it purely an internal Islamic development, or did it interact with other traditions?
That's been a big discussion for scholars. The traditional Sufi view, and I think most modern scholarship agrees, is that Sufism grew organically from within Islam, from the Quran, from the Sunnah.
But there was interaction.
Oh, undoubtedly. Especially in those formative centuries, the Islamic world was interacting with Greek philosophy, Christian monasticism, maybe Gnosticism, Indian traditions, Zoroastrianism. Some earlier Western scholars really pushed the idea of direct borrowing.
But the current consensus is more nuanced.
Yes. It's more about Sufism having its solid Islamic core, but perhaps assimilating compatible ideas or forms of expression from the surrounding cultures as it developed. Not wholesale borrowing, but intelligent engagement.
Okay. Then comes this period of, you called it codification, writing things down, systematizing. Why was that necessary?
Well, as Sufism grew and spread, it inevitably attracted some criticism. Some Orthodox legal scholars, theologians, were maybe suspicious of certain claims or practices.
Like the ecstatic utterances.
Possibly, or interpretations that seemed to stray too far. So from the 10th to the 13th centuries, you get these foundational manuals written by major figures, al-Siraj, al-Maki, Kalabadi, al-Sulami, al-Qashari, Hujwiri.
And what did these manuals do?
They laid out Sufi doctrines, described the path, the practices, the ethics, and crucially, they argued for Sufism's compatibility with mainstream Islamic belief and law. They were building bridges, explaining the tradition.
And you mentioned al-Ghazali playing a huge role here.
Absolutely pivotal. Abu Hamid al-Ghazali. He was already a towering figure, jurist, theologian, philosopher, but he went through this deep spiritual crisis and found answers in Sufism.
And he wrote
his magnum opus, Iha Ulumandin, The Revival of the Religious Sciences. It's this incredible synthesis of law, theology, ethics, and Sufi spirituality. It was massively influential in making Sufism respectable, integrating it into mainstream Sunni thought.
Wow, a real turning point in the 13th century, often called the Golden Age.
You could definitely say that. It was an incredible period of flourishing. You have Muhyi al-Din ibn Arabi.
The greatest master.
Al-Sheikh al-Akbar, yes. Developing his vast, complex metaphysical system around Wahdat al-Wujud, the unity of being. Hugely influential, though also controversial.
And Rumi.
And Jalal al-Din Rumi. His mystical poetry, especially the Masnavi, is just sublime. It captured the heart of the Sufi experience of love and longing for the divine. Immense impact, especially in the Persianate world and beyond.
So we have these great individual figures, these foundational texts, and then the emergence of organized orders, the Turuk. How did that happen?
It seems to have been a gradual shift, really taking off from the 12th century onwards. Instead of just individual masters and their small circles, you start seeing these more structured brotherhoods or fraternities forming.
Named after their founders.
Often, yes. Or sometimes their place of origin, like the Qadiriyya, named after Abd al-Qadir al-Jilani. Or the Chishtiyya from Chisht in Afghanistan.
And these orders develop their own specific flavor.
Exactly. They developed specific litanies, rituals, forms of dhikr. They formalized the master-disciple relationship, the sheikh and the murid.
And the lineage, the silsila.
Crucially important. The silsila is the chain of transmission, tracing the order's spiritual authority back generation by generation, ultimately to the Prophet Muhammad. It authenticates the teaching.
And they established physical centers, too.
Yes, that was vital for their spread. Places like Kankaz, Zawiyas, Tekis, Ribats. These lodges became centers for teaching, communal practice, sometimes social welfare, too.
So the orders were key to popularizing Sufism and spreading it geographically.
It's absolutely essential. This organizational structure allowed Sufism to be transmitted effectively across vast distances and diverse cultures, adapting as it went.
Ooh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah.
Ah, excellent timing.
Let's see. It's chai. It's definitely got a bit of a bitter edge today. Needs a good spoonful of sugar, I think.
A little sharp, maybe. Still welcome, though.
Definitely welcome. Okay, let's take a quick break for this, and then we'll come back and continue our exploration. Okay, welcome back, everyone. We were just discussing the rise of the Sufi orders, the Turuk, and how they were instrumental in spreading Sufism far and wide.
That's right. The geographical reach is quite astounding when you look at it.
Starting from the core areas like Iraq, Syria, Persia, where did it go?
Well, a huge influence in North Africa. Orders like the Shadiliya, the Qadiriyya, later the Tijaniyya, the Senussiyya, they became deeply embedded in the Maghreb and Egypt.
Sometimes even politically influential.
Yes. At times, they played significant social and even political roles. Then Anatolia, modern Turkey, became a massive center.
With Rumi and the Mevlevis, of course.
Definitely them, but also the Naqshbandiyya were very strong there. And Central Asia itself, the birthplace of the Naqshbandis, remained a vital heartland.
And India, South Asia, That seems like a particularly fertile ground.
Hugely important. From the 12th, 13th centuries, orders like the Chishtis, Suhrawardi, Qadiri, Naqshbandi, they were crucial in shaping Indo-Muslim culture, interacting with local traditions, and attracting many followers, the Chishti order especially.
And eastward still.
Yes, into Southeast Asia. Often, Sufi teachers and merchants, traveling trade routes, associated with orders like the Naqshbandiya and Qadiriya, played a big part in Islam's spread there.
And south into Africa.
Sub-Saharan Africa, too. Again, following trade routes, orders like the Qadiriya and Tijaniya established themselves and were significant forces in the Islamization process in West and East Africa.
We shouldn't forget Al-Andalus, Islamic Spain.
No, definitely not. Figures like Ibn al-Rif and Ibn al-Arabi himself originated there, though many eventually migrated east. And of course, much more recently, Sufism has spread to the West.
What helped it spread so effectively? It seems like more than just wandering teachers.
It was a combination of things. Those trade networks were vital communication lines. The Tariqa lodges, the Khanqahs and Zawiyas provided stable bases.
And adaptation.
Crucially, yes. Sufism often proved adept at expressing its core ideas in local languages, using local cultural forms like poetry and music. That made it relatable and accessible.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Moving into more modern times, say after the 18th century, it sounds like Sufism faced some significant headwinds.
It certainly did. The rise of certain Islamic reformist movements, most famously Wahhabism and later Salafism, was a major challenge.
Why? What was the conflict?
These movements often viewed many popular Sufi practices like venerating saints, visiting tombs, ziyara, musical gatherings, sama, using prayer beads as unacceptable religious innovations, bida, or even bordering on shirk, associating partners with God.
So direct theological clash.
Yes. And it wasn't just religious critics. Muslim modernists and secular nationalists sometimes had issues too.
How so?
Some saw Sufism as, well, backward, as superstitious, maybe passive, not fitting with their vision of a modern, progressive nation state. This sometimes led to outright state suppression.
Like in Turkey.
Turkey in 1925 under Ataturk is the classic example where the Sufi orders were officially banned. And European colonial powers, they often viewed the orders with suspicion too.
As potential resistance?
Exactly. These organized networks with strong local loyalties could be seen as a threat to colonial control.
So did all this lead to a decline?
In some areas, yes, particularly in terms of overt public influence, maybe among the urban Western educated elites. But Sufism also showed incredible resilience.
How did it survive and adapt?
Well, the orders often continued operating, sometimes more discreetly. New branches emerged. And interestingly, in recent decades, there's been a kind of resurgence or renewed interest.
Among who?
Among various groups, including educated city dwellers, maybe searching for deeper spirituality in the modern world. People sometimes talk about neo-Sufism to describe these contemporary forms.
And the spread to the West is part of this modern story, too.
Definitely. Through migration from Muslim-majority countries, but also through Westerners becoming interested in mysticism and spirituality, you now find Sufi centers and followers across Europe and North America.
Taking different forms, I imagine.
Very diverse forms, from traditional adherents within immigrant communities to Western converts joining established orders to more universalistic interpretations that draw on Sufi ideas but might detach them from their traditional Islamic context. And modern technology, the internet, has obviously created new ways to share these ideas globally.
So, a tradition with deep roots, facing challenges, but still very much alive and adapting. Let's dive into some of the core beliefs now. Tawhid, the oneness of God. Central to all Islam, but how do Sufis approach it specifically?
You're right, it's fundamental for all Muslims. But for Sufis, Tawhid isn't just something you affirm intellectually, it's a reality you strive to realize, to experience directly in your being.
Beyond just doctrine.
Way beyond doctrine.
Yeah.
Early Sufis might talk about achieving a unity of will with God.
Right.
Later, especially with thinkers influenced by Ibn Arabi, the concept of Wahdat al-Wujud becomes central.
The unity of being, can you unpack that a bit? It sounds complex.
It is profound. And often misinterpreted. Basically, it posits that true absolute existence belongs only to God. Everything else, the entire creation, doesn't have independent existence in the same way.
So what is creation then?
It's seen as a manifestation, zuhur, or a self-disclosure, tajali, of God's attributes and names. It's like reflections in a mirror. The reflections aren't the source, but they show the source.
The paradox of Henati.
Exactly. Creation points to God, reflects his reality, but it isn't God himself in essence. It emphasizes the underlying divine reality behind the apparent multiplicity of the world.
And this idea caused some debate.
Oh, huge debates. Critics, like the scholar Ibn Taymiyyah, worried it could slide into pantheism, everything is God, or monism, only God exists, blurring the line between creator and creation. They stressed God's absolute difference, his transcendence, Tanzi.
Were there alternative views within Sufism?
Yes. Ahmad Sirhindi, for example, proposed Wadat al-Shuhud, the unity of witness or apparentism.
How does that differ?
It suggests the experience of unity happens in the consciousness of the mystic. They witness everything as emanating from the one source rather than saying everything is ontologically one being. It's a subtle but important difference, trying to balance God's closeness, Tashbi, with his otherness, Tunsi.
Fascinating. Okay, another core concept, Izan, spiritual excellence. We touched on it, but how do Sufis see its role?
For Sufis, achieving Izan is the goal. Remember the definition. To worship Allah as if you see him.
That constant awareness.
Yes. Cultivating that constant awareness, mudakaba, acting with total sincerity, ikhlas, purifying the heart, striving for beauty and devotion. It's about living Islam and Iman, faith, at their absolute highest potential.
And divine love. Mahaba or Ishq, you said it was fundamental.
Absolutely central. A cornerstone. Inspired by Quranic verses about God's love for humanity and humanity's love for God, Sufism cultivates this intense, passionate, often selfless love.
What does that love look like in practice?
It's a yearning for closeness, a desire to please God above all else, finding joy only in him. Sufi poetry is drenched in metaphors of love, sometimes using imagery of human romance or even wine and intoxication to hint at the intensity of this divine love.
Like Rabia's idea of disinterested love.
Exactly. Rabia al-Adawiyya's contribution was profound. Loving God purely for his own sake, not out of fear of hell or desire for paradise, but just out of sheer love for the beloved.
Powerful. You also mentioned different ways of knowing, marifa and dalk. How are these different from regular learning?
Sufism puts a premium on direct experiential knowledge over just book learning or intellectual understanding, ilm. Marifa is that intuitive inner knowing, that gnosis of divine realities. It's often seen as a gift, a divine illumination.
And dalk?
Dalk means taste. It's the direct, unmediated experience of those realities. You don't just know about the sweetness of honey, you taste it. That's the difference. It's knowledge gained through the heart, not just the mind.
I see. And finally, the concept of Saints Aulia, friends of God.
Yes, Aulia Allah. Individuals believed to have achieved exceptional closeness, qurb, and intimacy, wilaya, with God through their devotion and purity.
What characterizes them?
Deep piety, constant remembrance of God, freedom from fear and grief about worldly matters. Sufi tradition often speaks of an invisible hierarchy of saints.
Like the Abdal, Atad, culminating in the qurb.
Exactly, the qurb, or goth, seen as the spiritual axis of the age. Saints are often credited with karamat, miracles, or special graces, distinct from the miracles of prophets.
And their social role, tombs as pilgrimage sites.
Yes, the tombs of revered saints often become major centers for pilgrimage, ziyara. People visit seeking blessings, baraka, or asking the saint to intercede with God on their behalf.
But that's also a point of contention, right?
It is. As we mentioned, more puritanical or reformist groups strongly criticize these practices, viewing veneration of saints or seeking intercession as bid'ah or even shirk. So sainthood is both a core spiritual concept and a site of social practice and theological debate.
Okay, that covers the core beliefs well. Now let's look at the path itself. The tariqah, you said it's both a method and an order.
Correct. Tariqah means path or way. It refers to the specific spiritual methodology followed by a Sufi order, but also to the order itself, the organized structure that transmits that method. It's about systematic training, spiritual discipline, purification, all guided by a master.
And along this path, there are maqamat and awwal.
Yeah.
Stations and states. What's the difference?
Maqamat stations are generally seen as stable levels or stages that the seeker achieves through sustained effort and practice. Think of things like repentance, patience, gratitude, trust in God, love. You work at them, you attain them.
So they're earned, in a sense.
Earned through effort and grace, yes. Ahwal states, on the other hand, are more like temporary spiritual moods or experiences that come upon the seeker. They're seen more as gifts from God, not directly attained by effort.
Like moments of
joy, sorrow, longing, intimacy, ecstasy, sobriety. They come and go. They're transient waves on the ocean of the path, while the maqamat are like islands you reach.
And navigating this requires a guide. The sheikh, murshid, peer.
Absolutely essential in traditional Sufism. The guide is indispensable. They accept the disciple, murid, give them specific practices, dhikr, meditation, interpret their dreams and experiences, guide them through the stations.
It sounds like a very close relationship.
Yeah.
demanding trust.
Immense trust and obedience. There's that famous analogy. The murid should be like a corpse in the hands of the washer, completely surrendered to the sheikh's guidance. There's a formal pledge, the bay'ah.
What does the bay'ah do?
It establishes the spiritual connection, linking the disciple through the sheikh and the order's silsila, that unbroken chain all the way back to the prophet. The sheikh's authority comes from this lineage and their own spiritual attainment. Of course, this concentration of authority has also been subject to criticism at times.
Understandable. So what are the key practices on this path? What does a Sufi do?
The absolute foundation is dhikr, remembrance of God.
Constantly invoking God's names.
Yes, repeating names like Allah, Hu, or sacred phrases like the Shahada. It can be vocal, jari, or silent, kafi, done alone or in group, sometimes in rhythmic sessions called hadra. The goal is perpetual awareness of God, emptying the heart of everything else. Often uses prayer beads, tasbih, or sibha.
What else besides dhikr?
Meditation, murakaba, and contemplation figure are crucial. Focusing the mind and heart on God, his attributes, his signs in creation, and tazkiyat al-nafs, or mujahada.
Purification of the self, the struggle.
Exactly. The inner struggle against the ego, the nafs, and its lower desires. It's not about destroying the ego, but taming it, redirecting its energies towards God, cultivating virtues.
Ascetic practices play a role too. Zuhd.
Often, yes. Renouncing excessive attachment to the world. Things like voluntary fasting, minimizing sleep, food, even talk. Embracing spiritual poverty. Fuck, willingly.
And the ultimate goal, fana and baka, annihilation and subsistence.
Yes, these represent the apex of the path. Fana is the passing away, the annihilation of the limited self, the ego, in the overwhelming presence of the divine. It started as an ethical concept, but evolved into this idea of the extinction of the sense of separate selfhood. Die before you die, as the saying goes. Or take on the qualities of God.
And baka.
Baka is subsistence, remaining. After the ego is annihilated, the seeker finds true abiding existence in and through God. It's a state of permanent transformation.
Wow. And there's that model of the four stages, Sharia, Tariqa, Hakika, Marifa. How does that fit in?
It's a common framework to understand the progression. Sharia is the foundation, the outward Islamic law governing conduct. It's like the body or the trunk of the tree.
The necessary starting point.
Absolutely. Tariqa is the path itself, the specific Sufi methodology, the inner dimension of Sharia. It's like the branches or the journey guided by a star.
Leading towards.
Towards Hakika truth or reality. This is the attainment of direct inner vision of the essential truth behind things. It's the fruit on the branch or the moon.
And finally, Marifa.
Marifa is gnosis. That deep, experiential, intimate knowledge of God that comes from realizing the hakika. It's the kernel inside the fruit, the fragrance of the flower, the sun itself.
So they're sequential but interconnected. You need the outer form to access the inner path, to reach the truth, and gain knowledge.
Precisely. They're seen as concentric circles or layers, each necessary, building upon the last. You don't discard Sharia to follow Tariqa. Tariqa is the way to realize the inner spirit of Sharia, leading ultimately to Hakika and Marifa.
That clarifies the structure nicely. Mm. Now, let's look closer at some of those major Sufi orders, the Turuq we mentioned, the Qadiriyya, for example.
Right, attributed to Abd al-Qadir al-Jilani in 12th century Baghdad. Possibly the oldest major order, generally seen as quite orthodox Sunni.
What are his characteristics?
Emphasis on following the Sharia, philanthropy, humility, piety, moderation. Al-Jilani himself viewed Sufism as a jihad against the ego. It's often quite loosely organized, with regional variations, huge veneration for the founder. His tomb in Baghdad is a major pilgrimage site.
And it spread incredibly widely.
All over. North Africa, Central Asia, India, Ottoman lands, China, Africa, Southeast Asia. Really global reach.
Okay, what about the Naqshbandiyya?
Named after Bahauddin Naqshband Bukhari, 14th century Central Asia, its lineage uniquely goes back to Abu Bakr.
Key features.
Strong emphasis on strict adherence to Sharia and Sunnah, a sober style of mysticism, famous for its silent dhikr, dhikr kafi, often quite involved in social and political life, historically defending Sunni orthodoxy.
Also widespread.
Very. Central Asia, Ottoman Empire, India. Ahmad Serhindi was a major Naqshbandi figure there. Syria, Egypt, China, Southeast Asia, Balkans. Important suborders like the Mujahideen and Khalidiyya emerged too.
Then the Chishtiyya, prominent in South Asia.
Yes, originates near Herat, but really established in India by Muin al-Din Chishti in Ajmer in the 12th, 13th century.
Their emphasis.
Love, tolerance, openness, service to humanity. Traditionally stressed, staying aloof from rulers, embracing poverty. distinctive for their use of Sama spiritual music, especially Qawwali, deeply influential in the subcontinent. Mu'in al-Din's shrine in Ajmer is a massive pilgrimage center for people of many backgrounds.
And the Mevlevi order, associated with Rumi.
Founded by Rumi's followers after his death in 13th century Konya, Turkey, famous, of course, for the Sima, the whirling ceremony.
What's the focus?
Love, tolerance, the arts, Rumi's poetry, music as means of spiritual realization. Historically, perhaps a bit more oriented towards the elite. Leadership often passed through Rumi's descendants, spread mainly within the Ottoman sphere, and has seen a modern revival, including in the West.
Lastly, the Shadhiliya.
Founded by Abu al-Hasan al-Shadhili in North Africa, Egypt in the 13th century.
Their approach.
Interesting, because they generally encouraged integrating spiritual life with worldly affairs. No need for extreme withdrawal for most followers. Emphasis on God consciousness in daily life. Gratitude. Reliance on God. Known for powerful litanies called hizbs, like the Hizb al-Bahr. Very influential in North Africa and Egypt, with many branches globally.
That gives a great sense of the diversity among the major orders.
Right.
Let's quickly recap some of the key individual figures we've mentioned, just to place them. Rumi.
13th century. Persian mystical poet Nonpareil. Transformed by his encounter with Shams of Tabriz. Masnavi and Diwani Shams, all about divine love, inspired the Mevlevi order, still globally beloved,
Ibn Arabi,
12th, 13th century, al-Shaykh al-Akbar, Andalusian master metaphysician, prolific writer, elaborated Wadat al-Wujud, works like Futuhat al-Makkiyah, Pusus al-Hikam, profoundly shaped later Sufi thought, both admired and debated.
Al-Ghazali.
11th, 12th century, jurist, theologian, philosopher, mystic, huge figure. His spiritual crisis led him to Sufism. His Ihya Ulum al-Din integrated Sufism into mainstream Sunni Islam. Absolutely crucial figure.
And Rabia al-Abuya.
8th century. Early, revered female mystic from Basra. Pioneered the concept of disinterested love, loving God purely for his own sake. A foundational figure for the path of love.
Amazing figures. Their influence is undeniable.
Truly giants of Islamic spirituality and thought.
Well, as we wrap up this initial exploration, it's really clear that Sufism, tasawwuf, is this incredibly deep, rich, and varied dimension of Islamic life. Mm. It's all about that inner journey, that quest for closeness to God.
From those early simple beginnings in asceticism, through the complex philosophies of Ibn Arabi, the heart-melting poetry of Rumi, the structuring influence of the orders, it's left such a huge mark.
And it's still evolving, still finding ways to speak to people today, facing challenges, but also showing real resilience. That core desire for a direct, personal, experiential connection with the divine, it clearly resonates across time and cultures.
It really does. It makes you think, doesn't it? What is it about that quest for inner knowledge, for that overwhelming divine love that continues to draw people in?
A question to ponder. This has really only scratched the surface, of course. There's so much more to explore within the vast landscape of Sufi thought, history, and practice.